Cultivating Leadership for Tomorrow's Schools of Education by Matt Hartley and Tom Kekskemethi. Schools of education are at a crossroads. David Labarie argues in The Trouble with Ed Schools, hardly an encouraging title, that their predicament stems in part from the historically low status of the teaching profession. Furthermore, measuring the impact of teacher preparation, a central activity of these education schools, is a fantastically difficult proposition, which leaves the schools vulnerable to accusations, fair or otherwise, of poor instruction. In the research arena, they fare no better. Society would dearly love ed schools to discover the alchemical blend of policies and practices needed to fix our education system. But it is an elusive task. The problems are systemic, highly complex, and seemingly intractable. Given these circumstances, solutions advanced by educational researchers are often, by necessity, context-bound and conditional. As Labarie ruefully notes, quote, "If Sisyphus were a scholar, his field would be education," end quote. However, many ed schools are grappling with key educational issues: improving teacher preparation, cultivating educational leadership, closing the achievement gap, defining the role of education in a deliberative democracy, and they have significant strengths that can be brought to bear on these issues. Many of their faculty members have long-standing relationships with local teachers and administrators, first-hand knowledge of the day-to-day challenges of the classroom, and important insights into the connections between pedagogy and policy. Professors of education tend to have a strong interdisciplinary bent and considerable experience working across methodological lines and epistemological traditions. Ed schools also serve as the professional gateways through which the vast majority of U.S. teachers and school administrators pass. Despite these strengths, the efficacy of ed schools has been regularly questioned, and increasingly so in recent years. George Will, for example, has rather dramatically called for the closure of all schools of education, claiming that their curricula are wholly vacuous and inordinately bound to progressivist ideology. More measured criticism has come from within the academy as well, the latest salvos being three sobering reports from Arthur Levine that recommended, among other things, the closure of a healthy number of teacher preparation programs and the abolition of the Doctor of Education degree. Jerome Murphy, a former dean of Harvard's Graduate School of Education, fears that despite this clamor for change, the mounting pressure on ed schools still may be insufficient to spur widespread reform. That said, he sees this as a propitious time for some schools to look anew at their service to the field. Murphy urges ed schools to become places where faculty and practitioners collaborate to fashion curricula aimed at preparing teachers and administrators to address pressing contemporary problems. He calls for research of greater analytic sophistication and richer insight, as well as interventions that are a part of an expansive agenda born out of long-standing partnerships. However, Murphy argues that such change cannot occur without bold thinking, and that academic leadership is a principal part of the equation. And significant change, he stresses, would require the leadership of ed school deans. Developing that sort of leadership cannot be left to chance. Yet many individuals with the capacity to become effective deans never entertain the possibility. How then can ed schools foster future leaders? This question inspired a group of 11 education school deans to ponder how they might play a role in cultivating future leaders for ed schools themselves. The group was originally drawn together through the Spencer Foundation's Research Training Grant, RTG, program, a pre-dissertation fellowship program aimed at improving training for doctoral students in schools of education. The deans caucused regularly, discussing issues such as practitioner preparation, advances in research, and the improvement of doctoral training. They also discussed the challenges and responsibilities of ed schools in an era of tumultuous reform. One particular concern that emerged from their interactions was identifying and preparing a new generation of leaders to navigate today's shifting terrain. Many of the deans recalled feeling unprepared, even disoriented, when they stepped out of the ranks of the professoriate and into a senior administrative position. They worried that, with ed schools in an embattled state, promising candidates might decline a deanship because of ill-founded preconceptions about the nature of the work. From these conversations emerged the idea for a two-day leadership conference for mid-career faculty members who were identified as having notable scholarly strengths and leadership potential. Funded by the Spencer Foundation, the conference was held in June 2006 and consisted of a series of plenary sessions, addresses, and concurrent workshops on academic leadership, the deanship, and tasks of leadership in schools of education. In all, 18 sitting deans, former deans, and invited presenters led conference sessions for 41 conference participants, all of them mid-career and senior faculty members from 9 U.S. schools of education and from South Africa. In the discussion that follows, we attempt to convey the spirit of the discussions that occurred during this meeting and to highlight some of the ideas that emerged regarding how leadership for ed schools might be cultivated. Our observations are drawn from detailed notes taken during the sessions, whose format assumed the general pattern of one or more presentations followed by a group discussion. We also conducted a focus group with approximately a dozen mid-career faculty members who attended the conference. That conversation explored the participants' views on the role of the dean and the opportunities for leadership in their own schools of education. Finally, two conference participants and all of the Spencer RTG deans were given copies of an earlier version of this article and invited to comment on it. We are grateful for their additional insights and observations. Leadership, off the radar screen. A sentiment voiced by the vast majority of mid-career conference participants with whom we spoke was that the prospect of someday becoming a dean struck them as a remote, even fanciful notion. One remarked, quote, "I was a bit surprised when I got the invitation. A dean? Me?" End quote. It may be tempting to view such protests as an expression of what Henry Rosofsky calls the expectation of reticence among the professoriate, where it is generally felt to be, quote, bad form for a professor to admit the desire for administrative office, end quote. However, the issue was not one of social stigma. Being at professional schools, indeed, schools that prepare educational administrators, the participants readily acknowledged the importance of leadership. Instead, they pointed to other factors that collectively prevent faculty members from seriously considering a senior administrative post. First, faculty members find their own work, teaching, advising doctoral students, and developing new research and service projects, immensely satisfying, and job satisfaction rarely leads one to seek out new opportunities. Moreover, the tasks and responsibilities of the deanship are unclear to most faculty members. despite regular contact with their own deans and even a fair measure of curiosity, conference participants confessed that they knew relatively little about the work of deans. One recently appointed dean, for example, was amazed to discover how much time and energy the leadership of his university devoted to thoughtful strategic planning and the development of new initiatives. He remarked that, from the vantage point of a faculty member, he never would have suspected it. Another participant, a full professor, admitted, quote, "I decided to come to the conference because I realized I really have no idea what the dean does. So the thought of becoming one is pretty much off the radar screen," end quote. Of course, it must be said that the experiences of professors with departmental meetings and school committees, the administrative activities they are most likely to take part in, are often far from intellectually stimulating. Too often, service to one's own institution ends up being what has been described as high-powered people doing low-level work. The prospect of becoming chair of a department, traditionally a milestone on the way to a higher administrative post, is something to be submitted to, a form of service to be endured. However, this perspective changed markedly during the meeting, as the participants listened to current and past deans share their experiences. In our view, one of the most important outcomes of the conference was it afforded the time and space for reflection so that participants could examine the complexities and possibilities of being a dean in the company of colleagues who shared an abiding concern about the future of schools of education. The conversations at the conference were spirited and frank. Participants grappled openly with the current status of education schools at many universities, the relentless imperative for and rewards of fundraising, the challenges that epistemological diversity brings to faculties of social science, and the public accountability of education schools and educational researchers. Dedicating time to thinking through these issues gave these prospective leaders an opportunity to consider honestly the realities and opportunities of leadership, and gave sitting deans the chance to offer their views on the professional and personal rewards of their jobs. A fuller understanding of deaning. The gap between prospective leaders' conceptions of the deanship and the realities of the job is understandable. A dean's work is, in fact, substantially different from that of an independent faculty member. For those currently committed to an engaging research agenda, the possibility of becoming a dean seems to entail a significant sacrifice, and the majority of deans reported that after becoming dean, they had not been able to maintain anything like the same level of research productivity that they had before, at least not in their early years of settling into the job. It is a mistake, however, to conclude that becoming a dean means trading academic autonomy for a lofty title, administrative headaches, and a regular diet of nondescript salmon or chicken at official dinners. Quite the contrary. The deans at this gathering consistently described their work as immensely rewarding and intellectually engaging. A single example of this came from a dean who reflected on how much she had learned from participating in tenure reviews. Reviewing tenure cases from across the university, she argued, exposed her to the most current and innovative research from a range of disciplines and from other professional schools. She was then able to draw imaginative connections between the other scholars' work and the challenges in education that she and her faculty were addressing. Another dean observed that the need to raise funds, lots of funds, required not only that he have a clear grasp of the academic strengths of his faculty, but also that he learned to connect faculty strengths to the interests of philanthropists. He used the interests of potential donors as the impetus to grow new cross-disciplinary research collaborations in his school. The deanship also provides an unparalleled perch from which to engage some of the most complex and important educational issues of our time. Deans frequently collaborate with other senior administrators on university-wide initiatives that can and do focus on educational issues. This is most obvious in the growing number of creative university-school partnerships that have been developed in recent years, often with schools of education playing leading roles. One panelist at the conference emphasized the intellectual challenge of working with faculty members to create a school that balances responsiveness to the field with the imperative to contribute to scholarship. Professional schools, he reflected, are in a kind of double bind, so-called hyper-academicness. Highly theoretical, discipline-based scholarship tends to draw ed schools away from practice and risks rendering them professionally irrelevant. But excessive emphasis on job preparation can compromise a school's status within the university. The ed school most likely to succeed in the years ahead will be one that is able to link professionals grappling with the most pressing issues in the field with the most up-to-date disciplinary knowledge to shed light on the complexities of practice and suggest possible avenues toward improvement. In sum, a dean's work is complex, illuminating, engaging, and full of unexpected challenges and opportunities. Sitting and former deans spoke of the pride they felt in their school's involvement with local public schools, of their contributions to national discussions on professional accreditation, of their responsiveness to the needs of practicing professionals through innovative academic programs, and of their leadership on campus in the development of interdisciplinary research. Many conference participants had already held positions of significant responsibility as department chairs, associate deans, and directors of research institutes. But for most of them, the unique obligation of deans to be primarily concerned with the advancement of collective institutional interests above all else was uncharted terrain. This circumstance contributes substantially to the principal challenge that ed school leaders face, bringing independent-minded faculty colleagues together around the establishment and achievement of larger institutional goals. One panel presenter articulated a widely echoed view of deans' leadership. Quote, "Deans don't manage, they draw out the capacities of others," end quote. But managerial acumen, political savvy, and creative foresight are not magically conferred on faculty members who move into leadership posts. In an essay on leadership remarkable for its careful attention to specific traits of successful leaders and the extent to which leaders must be sensitive to the context in which they lead, former Duke University President Nannerl Keohane asks, quote, "Which of these traits and skills can be taught or learned? How many can be gained from experience? And which ones are innate, more like having perfect pitch than something you can pick up over time? A few of these traits are no doubt innate, but most, if not all, of these attributes can be learned or enriched through experience and practice," end quote. But how can faculty members who might one day lead ed schools be exposed to the challenging and very gratifying aspects of the job? How might they get more practice with leadership? How might they be encouraged to take a more global view of their schools and of the field? How might they develop a deeper interest in institutional accomplishment. Finding the next generation of ed school leaders. Many corporations address the issue of leadership succession by tapping a favored few individuals and providing special professional development for them. Such a process is not well suited to the needs of the academy, which, organizationally speaking, is far closer to research and development firms than to so-called machine bureaucracies. Compared to corporations, there is precious little hierarchy. For tenured faculty members, there are no bosses. Those who have had the opportunity to step into positions of formal leadership at universities, for example, associate or acting deanships, quickly learn that a title does not convey authoritative power. Patricia Graham, former dean of the Harvard Graduate School of Education, quipped, quote, "When you're an interim dean, you can't afford to act like the permanent dean. Of course, when you're permanent dean, you can't afford to act like that either," unquote. In the academy, leadership is enacted through consensus building and persuasion, and any initiative aimed at substantially reshaping the work of a school or university, curricular reform is one example, will fail without the active and willing participation of a clear majority of the faculty. Instead, the cultivation of future leaders of ed schools begins by providing opportunities for faculty members at all stages of their careers to contribute meaningfully to the strategic work of their schools. Lee Shulman was careful to point out to the conference participants that in his career in the academy, he had never been a dean or held a formal administrative appointment. Nevertheless, he still felt he had enjoyed plenty of opportunities to lead. He said, quote, "We need a more capacious understanding of what leadership is. I don't want all of the participants in this conference to be deans because we need leaders populating the faculty more broadly," end quote. Schools of education, and in particular their deans, must create conditions favorable to the development of the next generation of leaders by inviting faculty members with the potential to lead to have a stake in the future of their institutions. The organizational context is often ill-suited to these purposes. Some schools are quite centralized, whether because of their size or simply from institutional custom. Although this allows for greater efficiency, it also constrains the number of faculty members who are actively engaged in academic governance. One ed school with which we are familiar, not in attendance at this meeting, operates as a set of independent divisions and holds just one faculty meeting each semester. The trade-off for the efficiency of this arrangement is that fewer faculty members have a sense of what is occurring outside the narrow confines of their departments, hardly a recipe for engendering a broad understanding of or interest in larger institutional issues. Balkanization is further exacerbated by the isolated nature and demands of faculty work, course development, research and writing, student advising and evaluation. A number of participants told us that they wished they knew more about what their colleagues were doing. Despite the perennial allure of food and fellowship, faculty members are unlikely to devote significant amounts of their discretionary time to quasi-social activities that they see as tangential to their core work. How does one go about building an authentic academic community? Our discussions provided a number of helpful examples. As we mentioned earlier, faculty members often see committee work as a distraction from their core activities. Although committees do harbor free riders, individuals who nominally participate but trust in others to do the heavy lifting, most faculty members accept the responsibility to provide service to their school of education. However, the work is often defined narrowly and the tasks are rendered routine. It does not have to be this way. An accreditation committee can easily craft a report to appease external agents, or it can cast its work in broader terms, using the occasion to engage colleagues in discussions about academic priorities. A curriculum committee can mechanically churn through prospective syllabi, or it can lead the faculty in discussions about using syllabi as pedagogical tools and establishing guidelines for their development. This is no mere matter of semantics. Too often, in the interests of simply getting work done, we miss the opportunity to invest our work with a larger purpose, and it is the dean who is best able, in consultation with the committee chair, to define a committee's charge in more expansive terms. Another strategy for combating balkanization is to provide resources for grassroots efforts being undertaken by faculty members. At one institution, a professor convened a small monthly lunch group for faculty members interested in discussing pedagogy. Another institution provided staff support to faculty members who created a year-long seminar in which they delivered presentations and discussed various issues related to the rigor and relevance of educational research. A third strategy is encouraging team teaching, particularly a version that draws together faculty members from different departments. The faculty at one institution has begun to engage in discussions about the implications of race in institutional life. The dean sponsored a faculty-initiated internal grant competition for research on race and education and issued a request for proposals that emphasized research bridging departments and disciplines. He uncovered a wide range of creative efforts. Such activities on the part of a dean encourage faculty members from various departments and disciplines to learn from and with one another about issues that they care about. Most such efforts represent a modest investment with a potentially sizable payoff in community building. A fourth strategy for fighting isolation is to draw together affinity groups from departments and disciplines across the university to encourage collaboration on research. Few societal issues are viewed as a higher priority than education. Ed schools have the expertise to contribute to and even to lead multidisciplinary research projects dealing with such critical problems as the achievement gap, access to post-secondary education, and the problems facing many inner-city schools. Research in and around such significant real-world problems requires the expertise of many faculty members from across the university. Faculty members from education, social work, and the health sciences are increasingly collaborating in such work, as many universities seek to promote community engagement. Such opportunities benefit participants in many ways. Effective leaders must develop two interrelated sets of skills, professional socialization and organizational socialization. That is, they must learn their professional roles and learn to read the organizational context. Many of the professional activities undertaken by deans, engaging in strategic management, supporting scholarly work outside one's area of expertise, working with board members or donors, identifying opportunities for collaboration across schools, representing the school's interests with senior administration and vice versa, fall outside the common expectations for a faculty member. Perhaps the greatest difference between the two roles is that any leader, and a dean in particular, is ultimately judged by the success of others. Academic leadership is, after all, a profoundly and frighteningly interdependent position. Professional socialization entails developing a richer understanding of these aspects of the role. Organizational socialization entails developing a deep understanding of the values, norms, and patterns of behavior in a particular organization. How is this faculty accustomed to being consulted, and through what avenues? Does collaboration or competition between departments characterize the prevailing ethos? For a new dean, attending faculty meetings can be as mysterious as a first Thanksgiving with the in-laws. You see Aunt Mabel roll her eyes when Uncle Frank waxes poetic about the joys of self-employment, but have no idea why until later when he attempts to recruit you to his Amway distributorship. Developing both the professional competence and the organizational acumen to tease out the various subtexts and histories that influence organizational life takes time. It also takes skill and practice. But deans can go a step further in their efforts to develop leaders for schools of education than just creating many opportunities for leadership. They can actively test individuals who exhibit nascent leadership capacities and encourage them to reflect on their work. How has your task force defined its goal? What's your strategy for moving the initiative forward? How are you balancing the disparate interests of the individuals or groups participating in the effort? How are you handling difficult individuals or navigating bureaucratic processes to get the job done? Conversations of this sort both enable a dean to gather insights into the leadership capabilities of colleagues and can lead faculty members to consider the prospect of becoming a dean. As one dean who attended the conference observed, quote, "often people can't see qualities of leadership in themselves," end quote. These conversations are a potentially powerful way to put the idea of being dean squarely in front of potential candidates. Our main point is that schools of education serve their own interests best when they take seriously the responsibility of preparing future leaders. People notice what leaders pay attention to, and their actions have a significant influence on organizational norms. By framing committee work in ways that are strategic and expansive, by initiating conversations about collective purpose, and by supporting and encouraging individuals leading joint initiatives, deans will have a better chance to see future leaders emerge. Conclusion. Reflecting on his years as a dean, Richard Borden, a professor of psychology and human ecology at College of the Atlantic, summed up his thinking on the effectiveness of deans in this way, quote, "Our individual creativity and institutional effectiveness depend on the metaphors and images that guide our daily agendas. It is incumbent on us to continually gather new perspectives and to refresh our thinking. We are each other's teachers. Our learning comes by sharing, and the cardinal points on our compass many times are the insights and counsel of others," end quote. The Conference on Leadership for Ed Schools that we have reported on here confirmed and demonstrated Borden's premise. Clearly, the conference gave faculty members who may aspire to the deanship valuable perspectives on the tasks and challenges of academic leadership and provided a setting in which all of the participants could reflect on broader priorities for schools of education and the ways in which those priorities might be served through their academic leaders. We have extended Borden's line of thinking here in order to focus on the cultivation of future leaders for schools of education. Indeed, we believe it is a particular responsibility of deans to nurture institutional norms and practices that give willing members of their faculty opportunities to engage in leadership. Deans should encourage collegial environments among their faculty by actively creating opportunities for faculty members to engage in concrete, mission-centered activity as institutional leaders themselves. Through exploring these opportunities, faculty members can experience the rewards of leadership, gain a better understanding of the very different, complicated, and satisfying lives of leaders, and perhaps come to seriously consider future positions of leadership. Ours is an argument informed by discussions that began with the conference, but it is certainly no proven method of cultivating leaders. Deans might do well to encourage research on the subject. Who are education deans? What are their characteristic scholarly and professional histories? How did they become interested in leadership, and how did they learn their jobs? Who applies and who doesn't for education deanships, and why? While these questions are worth asking of leaders and faculty members in any professional school or discipline, they are imperative for ed schools because the need to cultivate strong leadership there is so urgent. The group of deans who called this conference was concerned that the best possible candidates emerge to lead their schools in the future. That concern was echoed by a senior scholar who had been closely involved in a recent search for an ed school dean and told us, quote, "There are a lot of great people out there, but I'm here to tell you the candidate pool for great education deans is pretty thin," end quote. Our sense from this conference is that there are indeed a lot of great people out there, and that plenty of them might make exceptional deans at ed schools. However, from what we've learned, we suspect that not enough of them will apply for positions of leadership. More important, far too few of them have had experiences in their professional lives that would serve to interest them in seeking a deanship in the first place. It's time for sitting deans and all of us who care about the future of ed schools to get to work.